Everybody, I'm very excited to have John Henry Shirk, founder of Growth Plays, on the program. John Henry is someone I really respect in the content marketing, SEO world, business development, B2B. It's all John Henry's wheelhouse. So very excited to have you here, John.
Thank you so much for having me, Ross.
Yeah, I respect a lot of how you think about SEO and content marketing. It's kind of rare to have people that are thinking actively in a smart way in the space. Of course, not everyone has those incentives. There's definitely a lot of in-house people that I'm sure are very smart that do this stuff in a good way. But as someone who's a practitioner on the agency side, definitely in the weeds as well, just wanted to kind of pick your brain. It's early 2022. What's kind of, as someone who's building a high growth agency, like what's new in your calculus this year? Like what are some things you're thinking about that maybe you didn't do or you're evolving on from SEO or content perspective?
I think, wow, a lot's changed, I think, even like the last year. And there's like a lot more demand for SEO. But I think with most of the companies we work with, there's like less resources than ever. Like people are just pulled thin. There's a lot of initiatives. I think a lot of companies post-COVID have really had to like reinvent what they were doing digitally, take the money out of their events budget, and kind of figure out how to reallocate that. And with that, there's like a lot of new initiatives, a lot of immature programs. And I think one thing that I've just noticed is with a lot of the companies we work with, companies that still maintain like some pretty high rankings, even before we start working with them, the technical stuff, it's important to do. But I think I've learned that it's like less of a must have and more of a move in the right direction. I think early on in my career, I was very quick to like point out technical issues, really focus on them, and say, that's not on me. Like, I'm not the one that's not delivering growth. It's this technical issue that we solve, and then we solve it. And then it's like, well, that really wasn't the thing holding us back now, was it? So I think we're moving more into a place where it's like, let's publish great content. Let's get it out the door. We have Content King, which is a great tool running on all of our sites. So we can see technical issues pop up as they go live. It's not as drastic as I thought. And even if you look at some really big, strong companies, both like in public markets and in search, they rank. Like if you look for ITSM topics, ServiceNow ranks. If you run ServiceNow's website through Lighthouse or other tools, like it's not like a technically performant site. It's not technically a great site. I think a lot of technical debt exists on a lot of very high ranking sites. And more so than ever, I'm really focusing on like pushing new pages live, refreshing pages that used to perform or weren't able to perform in the first place, and doing things that are going to generate more links passively rather than like running outreach campaigns to get like 5 or 10 links. I want to set a piece up of content to earn 1,000 links over time. It's just like a much higher yield. And I think looking at technical SEO is less of a bottleneck or a blocker and more of just a discipline and like a muscle to build up over time. But yeah, we've worked with some sites that have had horrific technical debt where you'd be surprised they're ranking, but because they have a solid brand and solid positioning and people link to them and know to search for them and they have a lot of branded search as well, they rank very, very well. So that is really where I'm kind of thinking today.
As you were talking about that, some things crossed my mind in that wavelength. A few things are like, one, I've heard more and more CMSs are getting more proficient at just kind of out of the box technical. So I wonder if that's kind of like, not always are the issues as profound. But the other side, definitely on that point, I wonder if we need as an industry to kind of restructure that dichotomy between like content SEO and technical SEO. We're almost rephrasing it in-house where we have an SEO team, but I don't even really describe them as technical SEOs. They definitely need that as part of their skill set. But I wonder if it's more like site-wide SEO. It's more like strategic SEO, like there's definitely the execution arm and you still need that strategy lens, but is it actually technical blocking and tackling every single time? I don't know if it is. That other side's still clearly needed. Everyone's talking about it, right? But curious what you think about that thought process.
Yeah, so we have a guy on our team, Matthew K. Shout out Matthew K. And his whole job is really like abstracting the technical from customers. And I think that like, I look back on before I really knew much about web development or anything like that, I'm not a developer, but like I've worked on a ton of websites. I get how they function. I've had a lot of conversations around redesigns and whatnot. But when I was very new, having people explain to me things around website performance and like different decisions we had to make. I remember back way back when early in my career, we were like deciding whether or not to make a website responsive. And the developer, this guy Zeke from way back when, like 10 years ago in my career, great dude. He explained to me everything, gave me the exact amount of information I needed to make the right decision at that time. And that's really what we're trying to do. Cause like, I don't think, you know, our customers are like content leads and VPs of marketing and CMOs. They are not trying to get nitty gritty about like, how does search work? And why is this one particular aspect blocking this crawler? They want to know enough information and have enough context to make the right decision at the right time without having to get bogged down in the details. Our job is to kind of abstract the details. So that's all Matthew focuses on. He does a great job of that. Just like, here are the Jira tickets that you need to give to your team. Here's why they matter. And here's how they need to be implemented. And because we can have some trust with our customers, we're not always trying to like educate them about the basics. We're lucky that we work with some customers that are fairly sophisticated, get how websites work, have a little bit of SEO knowledge. They trust us just to give them the implementation documents and go from there. And I think that SEO as a service was so new at the time that we got into these habits of like, here's how bots work and this is why this matters and here's the elements. And we always kind of became these like educator, player, coach at the same time. Like we were educating customers, we were doing the work, and then we were trying to coach them to like get the things implemented. But like with the overarching theme being like constant education so that they buy into what we're selling. But I think at a certain time that becomes wasteful and it's not really the experience that all customers are looking for if they're not trying to build an internal discipline around it. So minimizing the amount of like SEO information being provided and just being like, here's what you need to do so that you are in a place to rank and publish and publish and rank. Like that's really, I think, where customers want to be. So more meetings, more details, more education doesn't necessarily mean more value, especially if the customer is not trying to get that education. So not a perfect answer to your question, but that's kind of where I think this is going is like, let's abstract it from folks. Let's not make them focus on it. To touch on the CMS thing, yes, CMSs do help you. Like the Yoast plugin does handle a lot of SEO for you. And I know it's moving to Shopify and that'll be a great move. Where things get tricky though is like I have a lot of customers that use Contentful and Prismic and these headless CMSs that are basically homegrown solutions. And several customers have kind of had to remake their own version of Yoast and it's not nearly as performant. With Webflow, I'd say like there is some, it's a great tool. We run our marketing site on it. It's basically like AWS Lambda for marketing sites. It takes a lot of the headaches and like managing WordPress has real costs. I got tired of constantly updating it to make sure we were secure. So I moved over some stuff to Webflow. But like Webflow, it gets tough to scale large sites on it and reconstructing like how a blog works and how a blog role works and making all those categories work. Like the logic that's inside of like a tool like WordPress, I think developers oftentimes discount it because WordPress has kind of a bad rap. But they have a core team that's just figured out like, all right, when this one edge use case happens, when someone unpublishes a category, like how do we handle that? And that's stuff that like the headless CMSs really haven't worked out. So I think like the one place where we have seen a lot of technical debt pop up are these homegrown headless CMSs where they're pretty easy to develop on, but they're really intended for like also publishing to print and direct mail and billboards and having that one content repository that can live everywhere. Like some of the stuff with headless CMSs is amazing. Like Burger King has one central place for their menu and all their nutritional information that flows through all of their systems. Like that is like the definition of amazing, but that's not what people need. And that's like actually the technology that they're using to build some of their marketing sites now, because it's what developers want to use because it's cool. But multiple CMOs I've talked to after everything said, we should have just gone with WordPress after like going through Contentful and Prismic and a lot of headless stuff. They're like, it was more heavy duty than we needed.
People want to do the sexy thing, right? I hear that in sales calls. I'm sure you do a lot. It's like a question we always ask is what CMS you're on. And it seems to go through these cycles of like, it was Contentful for a while. I feel like I'm hearing Webflow more recently and it goes through these cycles. And then WordPress is always there, always. But that brand cycles out of the conversation a little bit. But they're still good, obviously, yeah.
I mean, I'm down to use whatever. I think the only real issues we've ever had with the customer is when it's entirely homegrown and not even on like a platform like Netlify or Contentful. And it's just like, oh, we have to do like a deploy or it's like connected to our product. Those are like the only times where it's like, well, this is going to be very tough. But SEOs are quick to kind of focus on the CMS. It's like, oh, can Wix rank well? I remember that was like a topic for SEO Twitter for a while. And I think like anything can rank well. And I feel like SEOs as an industry look for things that hold us back instead of ways that we can create growth. It's sort of like a, let me find your diagnostic issues instead of like doing the hard thing, which is rolling up your sleeves and like pushing 60 new pages live that can rank. Like that is actually hard work. Telling someone that their CMS is unperformant is like the easy thing to do.
Yeah, agreed. And before we completely move on from the technical SEO conversation, should give some credit to, I'm sure those million page websites, I don't know if you'd say this is accurate, John Henry, like on average, working on content sites or B2B technical sites, the size of those issues aren't always the same as like Amazon or Walmart, the B2C kind of problems. And potentially that technical debt gets more significant. But now I'm sure you've had those conversations with e-commerce friends where they're actually seeing the same. I don't want to speak for you there.
No, I mean, I think it's like really a difference between product-led SEO and content-led SEO. And if you are doing something that scales infinitely, like Airbnb, where the more people that use your platform, the more web pages you have, the more opportunities you have to rank, it's in totally different discipline. And I have a ton of respect for that. I used to, early on in my career, work for a company, Built Visible, with Richard Baxter and the whole team over in the UK. And the stuff that they would do with like uncovering massive redirect chains through platform migrations that went errant 3 years ago before anyone was involved, through looking at log files and the growth that they would uncover for that. It was like insane, detailed, very technical work that did unlock growth. And there's a total place for it. But I think, yeah, there's a huge difference between a 7,000 page content site that's marketing a SaaS tool and a large e-commerce retailer with multiple category pages and thousands of products.
Agreed. Shifting to more of our butter and our bread, on the content side of things, I know you have some potentially hot takes of ways you're thinking about that this year, or maybe in comparison to how you're seeing other people think about things. What are those? And would be curious to hear those.
I'm kind of like you. I like to steal from the best. So I look at like, what are the sites that are doing millions of visits a month? How are they structuring their content? What are they doing? So I look at companies like Investopedia or TechTarget, and those are like page view driven businesses. Like they need the search. And I think early on in my career, it was really about like going and getting 30, 50 links on the launch for like a big guide that could rank well. And those big guides don't do too well anymore. I think manual outreach has a place. It's gotten much more difficult than it was 7-8 years ago. Your success rates are lower of getting the link placed. Your response rates are much lower. I think a lot of that's moved to like email and newsletter and kind of like off of like, you know, your website. I think people are more in inboxes and on social today than they are like curating their wikis about like resource pages. And I think that the content itself, what I see ranking at least very much above the fold is like very quick time to value, very instant gratification. Let me tell you what you're going to get out of this, or let me give you your answer. And then let you jump to wherever you want to go on the page so you can accomplish your job to be done and then bounce. And if you want to explore more, there's a lot of other things that we can do. But if you just need a quick answer, go get it. Like Smartsheet is, I think, like one of the absolute best at that. They have pages that rank for every type of like template keyword. And if you are not open to using Smartsheet, they have the Excel links right there. They are ungated. You can grab them instantly. You don't need to give over your email. I think that overall, we used to try and make things that were like very interesting, very clever, very thought-provoking. And now what we see ranking is things that just are very, give you what you want without trying to challenge you, without trying to make you think. And I think writers do like that interesting, engaging, thought-provoking content. I think it's better to try and send folks to that content from other articles in search than trying to bend your SEO content to challenge readers and not give them the information they're looking for and tell them that the problems they think they have are actually not the problems they think they have. There's room for working that in subtly, but I think we need to separate sort of the big brand building from like getting in the way of search intent and giving people what they want out of the content that they're accessing. So yeah, my move away from like clever content and like challenging the reader to give them what they want and then trying to get them to opt in. That's my one big change. The other thing I'll hint on real quick, and then I'll give over the microphone to you, is I used to just really try and mimic the Investopedias and the Wikipedias and the TechTargets, which like just give out the answer, make an encyclopedia. And I would just like give and give and give and never have any asks. And there's this really smart sales leader, sales trainer, John Burroughs. And he talks about how salespeople give too much and effective sales negotiations are give and take. You give and get with sales. And I think with content, it's the same thing. Like, you don't just give out your evaluation rubric for free or your YouTube video for free. Get them into webinars. Like, ask for their email. Make them give up something in exchange for all the value that you're giving them. If your SEO content is good, well-structured, and informative, they're going to have more trust and be more willing to opt into things that are gated. And there's some trends versus gated versus ungated. We can get into that. But I think if you're doing like top-down sales where you need a rep to close the deal as opposed to product-led growth, gated content plays a really big role.
That reminds me of Brian Dean's content upgrade concept. I think he's done it a lot less recently, but he originally had a lot of kind of email newsletter opt-ins where it'd give you some kind of upgrade, such as a PDF or something, to get on his list. And he just built a massive list from that concept. Like, structurally, formulaically, process-wise, one of the things I'm curious in hearing you say that and thinking about upgrades on a per, maybe it's not upgrade is the right term. You said webinar, et cetera. Like, how do you processize that connection? So if you have, say, like 20 posts, are you building 5 upgrades or webinar series, or maybe it's one by category, or is it custom to every post? Yeah, curious how you think about that first.
This is a phenomenal question. Phenomenal question. Thank you. Sorry for interrupting. A lot of the work that we do, I'd say most SaaS companies are taking on what they call product-led growth, but not actually, not like fully. It's really like hybrid product-led growth, where they have product-led growth for the self-serve small deals that can then work their way up to becoming a qualified customer that's worth sales engaging with. And then there's just sales, like sales-led deals, where they're not in the product already. And that's typically like bigger companies that can't just install the product and start using it because they've got like data processing agreements and whatnot. So you need to split up your content by who the target audience is. And for a lot of like the technical tools we work with, there's like developer or end user content, and then there's business decision maker content. And for like the end user content, getting more of those folks into the product to experience it and get value out of it while still, you know, peppering like sort of end user educational content or things that matter to like people in the community. And then like the total cost of ownership, business buyer, trend report, maturity model content. I like gating all that stuff because I want that senior decision. Like, any company you talk to, if they have both demo requests and contact us and like self sign up free, if you ask them what the value of the demos is always going to be like exponentially more valuable, like 20 to 30x more valuable oftentimes, sometimes more than that. So figuring out who's on this piece of content and what is their goal. Is their goal to actually start using the product? But for the business buyer stuff, if it's a technical tool, a lot of them can't even use it. They just need education and then to sign off on it. So it's really about segmentation of audience type per content and aligning your calls to action or your goals or conversion metrics to that audience and how they align to like sort of the product and the business.
That relates to one thing we're actually thinking a lot more this year about is kind of the structure of our content or blog or Learn Center hubs. So we previously had a content strategy that we deliver in the first month, and we'd always make recommendations to like how the blog post looked. It's like, improve the readability here, scannability here, to make it look better. And it was kind of like a forest from the trees approach of, once we have 100 pieces of content and all these mature campaigns, the blog index and the organization of that can be pretty fragmented. So same in your context, one of the things I hear from you when you say that is a lot of these content sections could also be organized around those two buyers potentially. Just curious, how are you thinking about that in your engagements? Does that come up in terms of how you organize kind of where the content is hosted?
I think we probably align on this one. I don't like the traditional time-based blog, because it's like, as the content gets older, it looks less valuable. And blogs tend to like, they organize everything by timeline typically, but they also tend to like make the date very pronounced. And it's like, oh, this is 2 years old. If it's like, you know, something about Kubernetes, a lot's changed. That's a rapidly developing part of the cloud. So it's like, is this content even any good anymore? So I like having evergreen resource sections that are not for the blog. And it's like, a lot of the content that we like to produce is like middle of the funnel content, like a buyer's guide for behavioral analytics solutions or like SIM logging product pages. It's not going to be appropriate for them to be like next to a company's like Series D announcement. And then, hey, we have a new chief revenue officer. Welcome her to the team. We want to not necessarily get folks that are investigating the brand into like that middle of the funnel content that maps the market for them. And we don't need to them to see like the tutorials that quickly lead into the tool if that's not what they're trying to get into. So I like making the blog more business buyer branded and more brand focused, and then having SEO be somewhere else, because when it's on the blog, it typically becomes a bargain. It's like, hey, we'd love to have this, but it's like, well, brand would never do that. So I like putting SEO in a silo, and I'm sure some people would disagree with this, but just being able to get whatever you want and not having to make compromises, because typically when you have to compromise on user experience, when there's things you can't get because of a brand deal or whatever, or like brand guidelines or whatever, you tend to lose. And I remember this with like a great example is, this is years ago, so I can just talk about it publicly. When I was at WP Engine, we focused the homepage to WordPress hosting and it ranked. And then over time, the product matured, became a WordPress digital experience platform, and the company wanted to remove WordPress hosting from the homepage. And that was a big part of my focus and a big part of how I was getting my number. And I lost that fight because I didn't bring enough, I wasn't skilled enough in my career. I didn't bring enough evidence to that fight of like, hey, this is a bad move. Here's what we should do. Here's the revenue this is probably bringing in. So I lost those rankings because brand eventually trumped me. And if I knew that, if I made SEO its own independent place that's easier for attribution tracking and being able to track like really like how am I contributing to my overall number, because those pages are just getting SEO visits as opposed to like also being something that the brand generates natural traffic to. But I think that having the evergreen resource where you can go in, update, have everything be on its own and get like pretty competitive and pretty middle of the funnel and help people buy, as opposed to like big brand announcements and cool, clever things. Like that is where the cool, clever content that your audience wants to read should live, is your blog.
I love that insight. Like it makes me think of, it sounds like you've got a lot of enterprise customers. We definitely have them. And we run into that wall sometimes where someone just owns a certain section of the site and we're like, we can't even publish over there. It's almost an interesting insight, not just for them. That's an obvious thing of like, we can't put content over here, but medium-sized companies that are high-growth startups become big companies. And eventually those issues, they're probably fragmented ways already occurring at some of these companies of like, you can't change that on the blog. Eventually, you won't even be able to touch the blog. It's a nice way of thinking about it to like maybe earlier rather than later, try and like elbow out some room for yourself and you'll be more likely to control that real estate.
The other thing that I've noticed with the blog is like the calls to action on the sidebar are often like what the brand cares about the most right now. It's like, hey, we want more people in this webinar about whatever. So let's put that call to action site-wide on like the right-hand rail of the blog. But what you can do if you have like an SEO focused portion is really make those CTAs contextual to the specific content that's on that page. And that's going to lead like message match, like the similar concept of AdWords of how you want like the same keyword and the same headline so that when they click in, they land on the page, they see the same keyword, they know that content is for them and their needs. If your calls to action are topically relevant to the content that it's on, and you're not just sandwiching in like some ebook that gets downloads, your opt-ins are going to be much higher because it's a deeper way of solving the problem at hand. So I like having granular control over the calls to action. I can't dive into who it is, but we've been working with one customer to like their blog just didn't have, it was pretty much just like read whatever you want. And then we changed it so that the right rail had opt-ins to relevant pieces of content on the side. And it's generating hundreds of MQLs now a month. So it's like, and the MQL is just like a form filled download. So I used to think of like SEO as this place where like we couldn't get too promotional. We need to just like get traffic. And then the website acts as this machine that captures the traffic and converts the user. And that's not really how it works. You need to lead a horse to water and then like force water down that horse's throat. And the way that you can, the way that you can do that is by advertising essentially like what the next steps in the funnel are at all of those stages. So that people that have those needs but aren't searching for them yet self-identify and jump deeper down into the funnel.
The way I think about that, and it seems like you're describing a similar process that potentially scales, is say you had four sections or core buyer personas or categories of content on your site, you potentially could tag ebooks against each of those and scalably have all that programmatically be shown on each of those pages. Is that effectively the thought process you take, or is there anything you'd add to that?
The one thing that we're seeing a lot now from even like not seed stage startups, but like later stage startups even, is like we want to also appeal to investors in our content. We want to let them know how big the market opportunity is. So I think like market sizing or like trend reporting or figuring out who investors could be in your content as well, because like small audience, but it is something that we hear more and more of, like how can we also, because if you're trying to own like the term creator economy or something like that, If you can define that category, explain how big it's going to get, and give investors an idea of the market size, that's worth executing on, because that's like a pathway of growing your company that's like rather important to appeal to the right people, get the right investors on there. So I'm rambling. I didn't prepare this part of the conversation at all, but I think that that's also something to consider.
I'm hearing, as a trend, I'm hearing you talk about trend reports on this call a little bit, just to kind of put more color on that. Is that the kind of thing that's living on a blog? Do you bring that as a consistent playbook thing? Like once a year, you should be doing a trend report for your vertical. How are you thinking about that?
I'd say trend reports are great. When I look at who's done this really well, Gong, the sales NLP tool that kind of tells you how your sales conversations are doing and how much you're interrupting people and whatnot, they do some really interesting content and they like weave it into all their content. If you look at their cold calling tips blog post, they use their tool to basically explain like what makes an effective cold call. And it has, I think, like 60 or 100 links pointing to it or something like that. It's a very good piece of content. So if you can create trends, like industry trends with your own product data, that's the move. I would want to have that in like a sort of like a Salesforce state of sales or some type of like opt-in deeper download. But I think the move there is basically peppering in those stats and facts on relevant posts and then providing people an opt-in point to like get the full report. So it's like, here's three things about like user segmentation that we've discovered in our annual report that you should know. Want the full report? Get in here. But I think anytime you can be a unique supplier of data and insights, that's a better piece of content rather than just like skyscrapering and regurgitating and like looking at like, if you're not going to bring anything unique to the fight, you're basically like, okay, like let's, I hope we rank. But if you have unique information direct from you that people that are searching for that want to know, you're in a much better position to rank. So I think trend reports are a way of basically setting your own trends and telling your own story. And if you can make that derive from your product data, you're literally using your product to set the path forward for the market. So it's a powerful tool and it can be worked into all of your content.
Would that thought leadership person say what you just described is thought leadership on SEO post?
I think it's some thought leadership. I mean, it's some thought leadership for sure, but I think it's like thought leadership is such a broad term and it's like,
it's, I mean, I guess it's data in content, which is still technically thought leadership, yeah, sort of, but I'm just kind of teasing. But
well, I'd rather have the data do the thought leadership for me than try and like position myself as just like, I've been at some startups where it's like, we are on a hope and a dream that this is going to work. We don't really know the market. We're learning it day by day. And like, let's make this stuff work. Like I have written for startups trying to do thought leadership when I was an in-house person. And it's like, I probably had no business writing some of that content. I should have leaned more on actual experts instead of trying to position myself as one. And I think that unless you are really damn good, like you are one of the 10 best people on the planet to be writing about this topic, you're more or less faking it. And the days of like the pseudo expert who reads some stuff and then can write accurately, kind of like being a journalist or like a summarizer, that's dying. And unique takes and unique information and contrarian views are going to become more popular. Like I like Jason Lemkin's blog, Saster, because that guy knows what he's talking about. He has a calculation to estimate ARR for a SaaS company based on the headcount. And based on the companies that I've worked at, it's pretty accurate. Like it's good. You're not going to get that from someone who's like, let me write about sales. Like what keyword would that align to? What thought leadership concept would that? It doesn't. It's someone who has deep domain expertise sharing it with you. And that's where I think content's going to go. Like that's what people like. Authenticity, being grounded in reality, unique information, contrarian viewpoints to the standard. Like here's what it is. Here's what you should know about it. So I think that real thought leadership coming from like unique product data that maybe tells a different story than what's assumed, that is very interesting. I would like to lean more on that than saying like, hey, company we're working with, what I need you guys to do is just blow the lid off this industry and have a huge opinion about everything. Like, no, it's not what they're trying to do.
I agree with that. That actually kind of ties in kind of nicely to some things I know both of you and I are passionate about is like the passive link discussion. So one thing we've seen be really powerful are on, say, topics on trends or statistics and et cetera, like the very blasé vanilla way of taking those pieces would just be curating third-party data. But we found like a lot of people who are searching those terms are very often not going to link to that post. They'll go find the data on the post. And in a way, your post is a seed source for more links. So your posts, your own client or your own business can put more of your own data into that statistics or trends post, you're going to be the reference point. And I've seen examples where like the hub has like 1,000 links, and each of the first five examples on that list have like 500 to 750 links. And I'm sure some of it is not from the post itself, but there's no doubt there's just this super powerful engine that effectively can be built out of that hub effectively.
Yeah. So when I was at DocSend, we did this study where we took like, and this was, I think, like before I joined, I was like lightly advising on some stuff before I was a employee, but they put this out and it was basically a study of like, how long do seed stage investors look at startup decks? And it came out to be like a minute and 30 seconds or something like that. It was like how long people actually look at your deck. Cause it's DocSend for reference. It was acquired by Dropbox, but it is a sort of like Google Analytics for PDF documents. It's used in sales and like M&A and like very important documents essentially that you need to keep secure. That study, beyond the links, it generated a few hundred links, but beyond that, there was like 90 to 150 people in that document at any given time in the day. Like it became the canonical source of information about what does the fundraising process look like. It's very old. Like if you look at it, like it says like the average seed round is like 1.4 million or something like that. It's a bit higher now. But creating this like unique information that helps people understand what the average experience will be like or what the process should look like, especially for things that are a bit uncommon or a bit opaque, that's like beyond the link value. Like that was huge brand building. We became a constant source of information and a trusted resource for people trying to learn how to raise money. And over time, it proved to be such a valuable publishing tactic or such a valuable content tactic that became a big part of DocSend's marketing after I was gone, where it was like, you know, what's the activity like in documents this week? Like, are all VCs on vacation because it's the week before Christmas, or are deals active? And the company grew way, way, way bigger than I ever like could have thought possible. And I mean that in like the best possible way. It became kind of a rocket ship. And I think a big part of that was sharing that unique data and providing those unique insights to people who are trying to raise money for their company.
Those big reports are just so effective. I mean, I rarely see them when you're bringing unique data. Maybe I just don't see them. It's a survivorship bias. But you see the reports and they always do. They seem like they do exactly that every time. But a lot of them are very heavy lift. Like, are you bringing that to clients today? I'm curious of like...
No.
Yeah,
it's like
feels like an internal, right?
Well, it's yeah. Like they have like a good customer data platform and like they have good data to use. It's easy, but like that's never been the case in my life. It's never just been like, hey, this SQL table has all of the insights that you need to derive value. It's a huge heavy lift. And I think as companies get more mature, the thing that I think is like you'd think as companies get more mature, their data gets better, but that's really not the case. I think the data gets dirtier as the company grows bigger. And it's things like, you know, we've worked with some pretty large companies where it's like, oh, we can't trust our Salesforce. Like that's not the system of record for us. Like we would love reps to update that. So I think it's like one of those memes where it's like reality and like, or like what you think it's going to be in reality on the other side of it. Clearly I'm a big meme guy. I can't mention the specific meme, but.
Too bad this is a podcast, so we put that all over.
I know. But yeah, I think it's really tough. And I know that DocSend, we were like querying Heroku logs to figure this stuff out. And it was a really heavy lift and there was multiple people involved. I think it's typically, if we're going to get a little tactical, probably something more that the growth team could do because they need to have those analytics and metrics anyway. So they're probably the right team to work with if you're trying to get that data. But you need something like a segment or something like that involved, or like some type of customer data platform to be pushing all your customer data to a data warehouse, because it's not going to come from just like, you're going to need help and you're going to need a lot of it.
One reason I'm liking the kind of building on a stats or a trends post very often is that can at least be a micro approach. Like just give me one stat this month, or like, can you give me this data point? I'll put it at the top. Or maybe you could do a simple post rather than a massive report, to your point of like the TLDR, maybe not. The report always does better, but.
If you've got a lot of users though, you can survey, you can do like one survey question a month in your product for your users and then report on them.
Yeah, and just ladder up slowly, make that argument. And I think you can do pretty well with it.
I mean, at a bigger company, it'll be really hard to get that done because you're going to be going through customer experience. Be like, hey, can we ask one question for a marketing survey? And they're going to be like, no, because we have our own questions we want to ask. It'll get more political, it'll get tougher. That's one thing though, just to like critique the SEO industry a little bit. I think like the first time I ever saw you was like, you know, 8 years ago, you were presenting some conference about please exit the link building or the best people steal or whatever. Was it Link Love? That was it. But, you know, I think there's been some like really cavalier attitudes of like, just, you know, go make it work. Like go ask those people and get it done. And it's like, that's a fantasy world. People have their own OKRs. They have their own things that they get bonus for. You're competing with the time for them to literally make more money. They do not want to help you unless they're incentivized. Like, I think a big part of SEO is actually like gritting your teeth and just executing in a silo and being very effective and staying out of other people's way while making sure other people don't jump into your path while you're trying to execute. And this idea of like, let's just collaborate and let's just do teamwork, that's hard. And that introduces a variable that could fail that you don't have control over. So I'd rather like not hinge the strategy on other departments if I can. It's like at times you're going to need to work, but anytime I've pushed for like a trends report or something like that and been like, hey, it's a good idea, they're like, oh, we'll take that into advisement. And then it comes out naturally on its own because it's a natural thing for a company that is engaging in like building a brand and doing thought leadership to do. But this idea that like huge systemic change of how departments collaborate and track data and talk to each other is going to happen because the SEO agency or the SEO lead inside the company is like, hey, we should do this. That's not what you're hired to do. If you can make that change, you're going to get promoted rapidly outside of just managing the channel. So, I mean, which would be great. Which is good. Go do that if that's what you should do, or if that's what you have the skills to do. But I think it's very hard to be like the content and links and traffic generation person being like, hey, let's change how we track data on the customers so we can do some crazy trend reporting. Like, it's a cool suggestion, but I think you need like C-level buy-in for that type of stuff.
And I wonder, like, I'd be curious, we don't have enough sample size, but I would guess a lot of the stuff is getting even harder in remote life, like kind of navigating those kind of barriers require multiple meetings, multiple interactions. You can't have the soft water cooler, like Joe, can you push this thing along for me thing? It's not really there anymore. And that probably just further is adding to that complexity of getting things done.
Well, the one thing that's good with COVID, though, is like people are desperate just to like, they're like, oh, we can collaborate on this project. I'm not just sitting in an Excel sheet. Like, I'd love to get on a Zoom and meet some other people. That's one thing that's going for us now. But I hear you, like there is less overall serendipity in offices today. And that's why I think we need to be really intentional with our communication. It's also why I think written communication is typically more effective than, like, let me take that back. Permanent communication. We're huge users of Notion. Having things locked into like permanent systems as opposed to a stream of feed through like Slack, like sending something over through like a Slack suggestion is a way for it to get forgotten. I've used Slack as like the pulse of the company, whereas like Notion is the system of record. And I think either an email thread that can get a conversation going that leads to a pitch, or just putting the pitch inside of Notion and sending people there. Like, if you really think this is what's going to move the needle and what you need to be successful, you need to make a very compelling argument against it. And most of the time I see it as like a light suggestion because people are unsure of the value. They don't know how to quantify it and they can't put together any type of projection of what it will do for the business. But even if the model is fluffy or like not perfect, if it's useful, it's accomplishing its job. Shout out to Tom Critchell on that one. But I think that it's
Tom's my hero.
No, he's great. But I think that course is also, if you're listening to this, and you want to be a better SEO consultant, go download that course. It's very good. But I think a lot of the times I've been afraid in my career to make like big confident bets of like, we need to do this because it'll unlock growth. And one of my best examples, this thing got deleted when DocSend was acquired by Dropbox because it was definitely used some data that we didn't necessarily have the rights to use. But we scraped the internet for like B2B case studies, created a big case study library. It was a huge launch and it was a big bet. It was one of the most impactful things I did in my career. Generated over 100 links. It was generating 10,000 visits a month. And it was people who build case studies. And that's what DocSend is very good at holding. So it was the right audience coming to the site, figure out how to be better at their job and aligning that with the DocSend brand. It was a huge bet. It took 3 weeks. It was something I suggested a while. And I finally just pulled the trigger and executed on it myself. That's really what I think it's going to come down to. Instead of like light suggest, we could do this. We could do 9 million things. We need to figure out like the 5 things that we're going to do that are going to get us to the next stage of maturity and make very concentrated bets. And I think that's just like kind of a bad habit that SEO has. Like, well, we could do this. It depends. You could do that. It depends. It's like, tell us what we actually need to do and make it happen. And I think that mentality is very different from the, what would be nice is a trends report. Who can make that happen? Because that's kind of like that. Yeah.
I agree. Something we do in proposals is like, we'll have a content strategy section and effectively say, you need to do this. In some instances, if you don't give us green light to effectively redesign your content section, we're not going to work with you because you're going to fail otherwise. And it is definitely true that engagements mature, and we've had clients that mature, and the world changes and some new strategy evolves, and we now have to accomplish some of these things. And we're learning some of that muscle as well. Like, you got to put your foot down and be, maybe not angry is the word, but some of this stuff, like, you're gonna lose if you don't get the shit done. You got to be vocal about it.
It's interesting. We come from a different angle on that, because some of the companies we work with, if they're promising and they're growing quick, like, it's worth it for us. Especially, we do a lot of work in the developers, DevOps, DevSecOps space, and the primary channel for growth there is organic content. Like, developers do not, they've got ad blockers on everything. They do not like sales. They do not like opting into stuff. They like to experience the product on their own, and they like to learn on their own at their own pace. So there's an interview with the CEO of Datadog talking about the content team they've built. If you are marketing to developers, it's one of the best reads about, like, how do companies structure developer content. And they basically found developers who have some interest in journalism and could write very well. And I think, yeah, yes, exactly. I think that for us, what I'm looking for is a company that knows its messaging and positioning, and it's battle tested, and it's something customers react to. I view SEO now as a place to amplify messaging and positioning, and to use SEO as a platform for, like, yes, thought leadership and awareness generation. But once you get past those basic questions, working in some product marketing, working in some demand gen, and working calls to action for account creation. And if a company right now does not know how to talk to someone they could sell into and get them revved up about the product, convert them, and turn them into a successful customer, we're not going to be able to do that on the SEO front. And companies do pivot their messaging later, but typically, like, battle-tested messaging works. You know, when you have product market fit, it's because people are asking to buy. And if a company doesn't have that yet, we can't just, like, rub two sticks together to make smoke on the blog and hope that they're going to find product market fit through content. They need to find it on their own through their own growth initiatives, and we can be an extension of that. I think the most difficult engagements we've had, the only engagements we've ever had to stop and just say, like, hey, like, we don't think this is going to be successful, we should pause, are when companies don't know themselves how to generate customers once they meet them. So we're really looking for, like, can we do handoffs, and do you have the language and the knowledge to take a handoff and make it into a successful customer? The blog stuff, I mean, I'd rather just be like, hey, like, work with this web design agency. They're great. We trust them. They'll redesign your blog. Like, I'd much rather, like, push that. I realize in much bigger companies, though, because you're talking about, like, hey, you need to redesign your blog. I have a meeting later today with one company where I think, if I was just like, hey, you need to redesign your blog unilaterally, we can't work with you, I don't think I would have gotten through procurement. I am much more open to compromise at an enterprise stage company, because it is such a heavy lift to even make, like, a single change. I'm much more into bargaining once we're at, like, the really high maturity stage, when you have a ton of authority. Like, if you're Red Hat, I'll take some bargains. But if you're a brand new startup, yeah, I do think, like, getting all that stuff dialed in from the very start is an absolute must.
I think we're on the same page. Generally, I am with you. So I think that's one reason we don't work with seed stage companies, also because SEO is just a risk, because they very often don't have product market fit. Maybe that's evolved now a little as the valuations are going more up in lots of different ways. But it very often Series A plus, because they have product market fit. And sometimes you're doing SEO content, like, 20% of those pieces could be completely whiffs on being able to convert people for that reason. And on the blog development side, I wouldn't go to them and say, do that yourself. We have all these resources internally to develop blogs, and we do it at cost. So I know they rarely come to us with that in mind. And most of the time, we're not trying to, if it's a B minus, even C plus, we'll probably say yes, and we'll figure it out. If you don't have a blog or a place for content to live, that's kind of it's tough for us anyways. So that's kind of more how we think about that. And try to get over that objection.
My big stickler now, though, is actually imagery. Because I've worked with some companies where the CDN, like, takes the image and kind of mangles it a little bit. And it's like, hey, if this is, like, not clear and crisp and easy to read, like, people are not going to want to stick around. And I think that's actually been tough. Like, image formatting, making the images crisp while keeping them small, figuring out how to do that across a large site.
while still having the site be performant. That's been one where I've been like, I've raised some more red flags on just like, hey, I don't think the images look great. I think it looks fuzzy. And if you compare it to, say, this other site that you compete with, everything looks crisp and sharp. It just feels like a bit more of like a professional organization over there.
Yeah, I see that as well. I literally just mentioned that on a training call yesterday, where I think it is a lot of sometimes Retina computers will, I would hope that's giving people the benefit of the doubt that Retina is like making it look blurry for those computers and not the rest. But I would generally agree. I mean, we're pushing harder on that. That's something like 2022. I might be more okay with kind of a basic looking stock photo as a small hero and the blog index having a lot of those. Like today, going to your point of copying from the masters, like Policy Genius's blog index, and you see there's a diversity of thumbnail styles that just create a premium aesthetic that kind of lift this company. Those are kind of things we're pushing on and speak to that kind of that quality that you're speaking about.
It's funny. I'm actually like, I'd say out of all the things I try and consult on, that's been one of the hardest habits for the companies that we work with to break, of like including, some companies have brand, like really cool branded images that I think do add some unique value outside of SEO. But typically if it's a big image up top, it needs to be something that defines the concept of what the post is about for me, for it to hit the bar for me. And there's just this, I don't know why, I think it maybe it's because default WordPress had like a place for featured images. And then we all just got in this habit of like every post needs an image. But I think if your image isn't adding value, it really shouldn't be there. If it's building on the brand, I'm open to that. But ideally, you can define the concept that people are researching if it's like an SEO piece of content. But that has been, there seems to be some taboo behind not doing that. People that I, like customers that we work with seem to be not open to the idea, or not as open as I'd like. I love my customers, by the way. Not as open as I'd like to removing images from blog posts when there's no purpose for them being there. And it's often like clip arty and like not super high quality. And like, it's the same guy on the iPad with the socks. Like he doesn't need to be there anymore. I know, you know what I'm talking about. But the office, there's only like 60 people in office clip art and we've all seen all of them. So investing in ways to define, like visually define the concept is what the way I like framing it is, it adds more effort to every piece of content. And that's something, that's actually something that we're really looking at differently this year that I skipped over. We're really starting to look at like per, like we're looking at the unit economics of content. And when we're like, hey, all this video content's ranking, you should produce videos for all this, that massively increases the cost of content. So unless the traffic is there, the audience is there, or the ACV is there, I'm pretty hesitant to be like, oh yeah, you should just go head first into content, make these like 10 tutorial videos that are going to get some views. Like, unless we can be really confident behind that, it's not worth executing on. Same with images that define concepts, you know, taking up a half day of a designer's time, unless you can really get yield some value out of there, it's not worth it. So figuring out what can we get out of this content from like an annual traffic and potential like conversion metrics, like just a model of like low and high bar, what could we do and how much traffic do we think we could do if we were ranking like positions 5 through 3 and then positions like 3 through 1, like what could we get out of this? And is the juice worth the squeeze on that one? Like, will we get ROI positive on this individual piece of content? And I think looking at that from like a 1,000-foot view when putting together a content plan is something that we weren't always doing before, because we were like, if it's important for your users, it should be on your site and you should make the best piece of content out there. Your category is probably growing. It'll get more traffic over time. But that's not always the case. Like, not every category grows. So figuring out what is this content really going to require to rank before putting pen to paper and putting it into the queue is something that we're really focusing on now.
I like that. A couple of years ago, we were more link focused and kind of iteratively ideating, and we shifted to a project plan keyword research model up front, which, looking back, no brainer. But like, part of that thought process is exactly what you said, where we ROI model it out and then we ROI model it against the time we think it'll take to execute the content, to then reprioritize that list of topics to execute against. And we're also in that process, which we didn't do before, which I think you do get when you're trying to create the whole universe, is you find opportunities to scale content. Like, if you did some piece on MailChimp versus competitor, you've researched MailChimp once, you don't need to spend the same amount of time for the next article. So maybe you can cut that in half per article. And that's kind of where all that process comes into play.
Yeah. Templatized page creation for sort of solutions and bottom of the funnel. Totally. Like, it's a repeatable process for sure. And anything that equals repeatable process, I get more interested in, because I can probably scale if we get the right people on board. But something, you know, I've done enough talking in this. So something I'm curious about with you, you know, you talked about how you were more link focused, and there's this like world of digital PR popping up. And I think, you know, for me, the big change that I saw is that this idea of like launching an asset that gets 300 linking root domains and then internally linking to other pages you want to rank, I found that as to be kind of a distraction. And it was a way that we could generate some links. But, and like, I did want a WP engine that like mashed up a bunch of hacked passwords and showed people like the most, we worked with an agency to do it. It did really well. It got like 300 links, 300 linking root domains. It was in a bunch of newspapers. It did nothing to grow SEO traffic. And that was when I was like, I don't think these like big linkable unrelated assets are really like the key to growing SEO, because at the other point, what I was relying on was the website to have everything in place to be able to take that link equity and raise all the posts to those other rankings. And I also expected that to work, when really the best signal is links to the pages that you want to rank. So constructing pages to be rankable and linkable, I think, is really like where the industry is going. And this idea of like, let's get some juicy stats that like can get in Time and on Newsweek and whatnot, and then get forgotten about in like a week and a half. And maybe they're very like temporal, because it's like, what just happened last week? And let's get some links that way. I think all that is kind of fading into the background. I'm sure it can still be sold. I'm sure agencies are still going to sell it. But I'm really seeing a move towards the content that you want to rank being the content that deserves the links, and shifting to producing that content so that it is linkable over time as a way to really scale and grow SEO, rather than these unrelated link hubs that are supposed to kind of be a rising tide raises all ships kind of a play.
I mean, I think there's something to that for sure. It's a case by case on every site. There's rarely the case, I would say, that is what you just described, where there's just like one hero asset lifting the entire thing. Rarely do we see that. There are sometimes like go-to pieces, like something that just popped in my head is student loan hero. There's like student loan debt statistics. That is just like this massive linkable asset. But they also have other things that generate links too, and they would not rank without those things. So we're for sure on that of like rarely, we're not trying to hit home run pieces. We've always been single, double, triple through search volume. Maybe not always through search volume, but that's where we are today. And with you, that we're trying to create compounding value. And we'll create like big assets. They're very often calculators or interactive pieces tied to search in some way that actually match the user intent that warrant that, versus just for the sake of it. Yeah.
Just to clarify that, calculator is like super valuable. That literally calculates a problem and gives someone a metric so they can go understand and like evaluate where they are and figure out contextually where they sit in the spectrum of their problem, or how much budget they need, or whatever. But like a post about the highest per capita break-ins in the United States, like an interactive infographic about like what neighborhoods are the most dangerous and least dangerous or something like that, less valuable. And I remember, because, you know, we've been doing this for a while, that was the name of the game 8 years ago, was like, let's get out an asset. And there was like, you know, a news desk at time.com that would like just take these things and republish them. And that was the whole, that was the, like the Movado play. I think Movado is a great example. I don't know what's up with them anymore, but they were sort of the kings of...
Not doing well, I'm sure. Yeah. That got wiped out. Because they were not product first. It was just like, let's get a shit ton of links. It's not connected to the quality of the page.
Yeah. How much does Harry Potter's apartment cost? And then do you want to buy a home in like Boulder Springs, Colorado?
Yeah. I've noticed it's a top... Maybe it's evolved in our industry, but it's like a top signal is you'll... Maybe I'm actually guilty of this. I'm like, for a while you point to people being these amazing examples and then you realize they're not actually doing well. And actually I should eat my salt. Props to whoever's Movado today. I did just check. They're doing very well actually now. So they've doubled. They went from 3 million to 6 million in the last 12 months. So in visits.
Yeah, that's good for them. I do think that's like, I'll say though, like I have, it's interesting because these SEO brands that like you don't really know, but in the industry you do. Like, I think a great one is Smartsheet. If you check out smartsheet.com, they're doing a massive amount of traffic. And if you signal in on just like their templates directory, I think they're doing like 400,000 visits a month on just that. they compete with like Notion and Asana and all those like no code productivity tools that are out there, but they're for teams. I mean, they are crushing it. They're a public company. You know, I don't think their brand is huge, but they have enough revenue to go public. There are enough users finding them, primarily, I think, through like search and paid search. But their content is phenomenal because it's all about like templates and jobs to be done and tasks in the office. And if you just need like an Excel template to go do scheduling and you just need it once, they give you that for free. It's ungated. But they constantly make the case of like, hey, if your data is constantly updating, if you need to do this all the time, if you need to escape the chaos of Excel, use Smartsheet. And the templates they give oftentimes can be uploaded directly into the product once you've kind of outgrown them. So it's a really smart, really smart play. I don't, and it's interesting. I don't believe it's like pure product led growth. I don't think they have I think they have a free trial, not a freemium play, which is like sort of what a lot of the no code tools do. But like Notion, which is great. I love it. We run our business off of it. Huge amount of like Notion TikTok consumer users who are using it to, you know, manage their workout routines or their dieting and habit tracking. Smartsheet, all of their content is like business use cases and all of their users are business users. And I mean, their growth metrics are publicly available since they are a public company and like they are growing impressively.
Yeah, I've actually seen anecdotally templates like keyword plus template in most verticals, as long as it's relevant to your business, is pretty high converting.
That's one of the more political things to get out the door, though, because every SaaS company competes with Excel, pretty much. Anything that you're doing, you can pretty much do it in Excel. Excel is a database. All SaaS tools are pretty much databases. The most political conversations I've had have been with people that lead like product marketing, being like, why are we giving out an Excel template when our whole thing is literally getting people off of Excel? If you can teach me how to have that conversation better, or Tom Critchlow, if you want to come on, do a little triangulation here, because I do agree, it's super valuable giving out those free templates that help people kind of get from point A to point B when your product is the mature point C. Very useful. But there is a strong push against doing that, especially when it comes from like the SEO consultant. I think HubSpot does that. I'd love for like Matthew Barbie just be like, I mean, they're fully bought in on marketing. They're the inbound company more or less. So it's, they do it. But yeah, I've had a real hard time being like, let's give out Google Sheets for this.
That's a fair point. It just happens to be the context of this client I'm thinking of that works, but I would definitely can see what you're talking about. This just happens to be a unique use case that I can't share with the client, but.
No, let's use one we both use. I think it would make a lot of sense for like SEM Rush if they had like an Excel or like a Google Sheets connector. I don't know if they have a native one, but if they did, giving out all of those Google Sheets things that in the Google Sheet had a little CTA of like, give us your email, get 50 free API credits, populate this sheet once. And then if you need to do it again, let's get a real plan here. I think that could be really powerful.
We actually have a post. I mean, I haven't tracked it back to say you saw this post, but we do get strong kind of secondary conversions from our post on blog post templates. It ranks on search. It's probably not enterprise businesses, but that's at least anecdotal reference. But I can say yes to that. But you can see why some people might not want it. It's like, oh, that's the secret sauce. It's like, no, you got to execute. But
no, I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll say this, if your product, this is not what I've ever said to an executive I work with, but we're just having a little SEO friendly podcast here. But if your product, like I would love to be able to say this in a meeting, but it's just would not go over well. But if Excel is like legitimately going to take a customer from you, you've got much bigger problems than this one piece of content. I think if someone can get by with just using Excel, they aren't a good fit for your product. And I remember this brilliant CMO I worked with, Klee Kleber, he was really responsible for a lot of the growth at Rackspace. He basically explained to me, like, the most dangerous thing that we could do at WP Engine was get a bunch of people onto the platform who were oversold and weren't getting the full value and were being overcharged. Like, we didn't want to get people on bigger accounts than they needed because then they would churn after the value wasn't there for them. So I think with a similar idea, like with Excel, if all they need is Excel and you're trying to get them into the product today, that's too much. If they can get by just doing that, let them do that. And then, you know, have your brand on there. Let them see that every time they log into the sheet. And when they're ready to move to the next stage of maturity, they can opt in for that. I think if an Excel file is a legit threat, we've got much bigger problems to worry about.
Yeah, that's a fair counter argument. Maybe just the marketer wouldn't take too much offense to that. You never know. Well, nice. This has been a great conversation, John Henry. Any like final thoughts or anything we missed on these main concepts you want to leave people with?
Yeah, I mean, I know people love tools, tips, and tactics. And I'd say just one tool that I'm really having a lot of fun playing with is Keyword Insights from Sugan and Andy from Snippet Digital. There's another one out there called, I think they compete with something called Keyword Cupid, but like I would never use that brand internally. It's like very, the plans are like dating and are we married? Or it's inappropriate. It's not meant for like business users. So Keyword Insights is phenomenal. And you can basically rip out like your Google Search Console data and you can kind of explore the long tail there. So, you know, Google Search Console only gives you like 1,000 words. So don't just put in your raw export with all your branded terms or whatever. Figure out a keyword, get like 1,000 of those keywords in Google Search Console, export it, drop it into Keyword Insights, and it'll tell you all the different types of like chunks of content, or excuse me, all the different chunks of keywords that align to specific pieces of content. So it can save you a lot of time trying to figure out, hey, we have this big list of keywords. What individual pieces of content should we be making? It clusters the keywords together so that you can not spend time analyzing the SERPs. It's still good to do some manual SERP analysis, and it's machine learning. It's not perfect. It doesn't catch everything. There are some opportunities that it, like by nature would miss, but it is a huge time saver if you're working with, you know, a list of 10,000 keywords and you need to figure out from PPC and you need to figure out what pieces of content do these correspond to. Really good solution. It can also do rank tracking on all those keywords and figure out which pieces of content you have that are already ranking for those terms. So it's a way to automatically process a huge list of keywords and break it down into units of production instead of like sort of ambiguous targets that we hope to hit one day.
Love it. Look forward to checking those out. Both those guys are great follows on Twitter as well. I know they're really smart SEOs. So that story about Keyword Cupid actually made me think of something I've heard that was internally shared at McKinsey, apparently, or this was a third party story where they were evaluating an email marketing tool and MailChimp came up. And I guess the CEO, I'm definitely winging this, so this could be completely wrong, but effectively the moral of the story was like CEO had talked about it and like, we're effing McKinsey. We're not having a monkey as the mascot of the company that is running our email marketing. So that's it's kind of rough, but I think that's a reasonable reason to.
I mean, the Keyword Cupid tool, it could be great.
Yeah.
I would really recommend rebranding so that it's not about like relationships and marriage and dating on the website. It's not something like I would feel comfortable giving to someone on my team to go in and use. Like I want things that look professional. And like, I actually, and also I want things that look mature. Like a long time ago, I told Moz, I was like, every other chart that gets presented in the pipeline review meeting looks like it's from Salesforce. But if I take a screenshot of Moz, there's like a little robot telling me I'm doing a great job. And like all the graphics look kind of cartoony. And I get that that's your brand and you're friendly, but it's causing me to be taken less seriously. Like I want to look like Salesforce. And basically what the answer was is like, I can't rely on that tool for reporting. I need to pull the data into Excel and make things that look like Salesforce, because that's what executives see and that's what they respected at that particular company. But I think really not just does the brand align with what we want to use, like is the interface something that makes sense for us? Like with Keyword Cupid, it's like little hearts and video games and stuff. And it feels like it's more for the affiliate world than it is for like the B2B and like agency services world, which totally makes sense. And that's why there's room for a tool like Keyword Insights to grow quickly. But I use a tool called Keyword Sheeter. I'm glad it just moved to keywordsheeter.com.
What is this vertical? This vertical has all the strange yeah. Associated names on the top.
Well, I think it's like, you know, Black Hat world and, you know, affiliate forums and whatnot. There's an attitude on those and it kind of gets transferred over and they're marketing to their audience. They're doing a fine job of it too. You know, like I think the customer that buys SERPWHO is pretty different than the customer that buys Search Metrics. They have their own niche and that's great. But I think like once you, cause like, and there was, what was it? SEO Mofo. And it was like Calvin peeing on.
That's what I was just thinking about as you were talking about. Yeah. Love that tool. And it didn't matter, but.
You know that got bought though. Yeah. Higher Visibility bought that and redirected it into.
I guess maybe the lesson is we don't need to show that to anybody. We just use that internally.
Yeah.
And that's fun when you're using it yourself. Yeah.
When I'm using it myself, I do get a little weirded. Like I don't want to send someone who I've hired remotely and have very little exposure to personally just being like, oh, hey, like, don't worry about this weird site with Calvin peeing. It's great. Like I want professional tools for a professional team. The other thing, though, that I do worry about with bringing in a tool like that into our process is like there's no SLA. Like Keyword Cheater is a free tool And I should really spin up our own solution or get something that has an SLA or that is paid that can scrape search data for us, because if it goes down, we're in some trouble. And I think SEO is like, people are pretty budget conscious. They love the free tools. They love the free hacks. I'm very willing as a business owner to pay for reliability, security, and performance. Like, if we can get the job done twice as fast with a paid tool versus a free tool, absolutely go paid. There's no questions asked there. But I'm more worried about, like, if it goes down in the middle of the night, will this like random black hat person that has this picture of Calvin peeing, will they get up and will they fix the tool? Or, you know, they don't owe us anything. It's free. I'd rather they have some skin in the game and we have some skin in the game and we have a relationship that requires them to be responsible for managing the tool. So as I have added a few more folks to the team, I've gotten a little bit weary of these free tools that have no SLA and are unaccountable to us being involved in like a core part of the process.
Yeah, I can see that, how that could cause some issues and doesn't scale very well. And I haven't thought about it in that way of like sending people to something that's not as professional feeling, but totally makes sense.
I mean, we were like the backwater industry though. We were the weirdos. We were the people that like couldn't really, yeah, we've grown up. The tools have not.
Yeah, maybe they're somewhat maturing, but some of those are memorable. So everyone will remember Keyword Cupid after this. I know that for sure. And I am a Mailchimp user. I'm a fan. So I think they're doing something right personally, but appreciate you coming on, John Henry. Definitely everyone check you out on Twitter. You want to quickly, is it J-H? You hit him with the words.
Yeah, just search for John Henry Shirk on Google and you can find my Twitter. It was not reserved with the intention of being able to say it out loud. That was not a good move.
It's not Keyword Cupid in branding.
Yeah. Two suggestions if you're gonna build a personal brand or start a business. One, get social handles that you can say and people can easily understand. And that also, if you're building a brand, same thing. If people can't hear it and type it in, you can't ever do radio. The other thing is, if you're going to build a logo, make sure it's something that can easily print. Those are like two hard lessons that I've learned over the last few years. You need logos that can be physically printable and you need social handles that people can easily get to if you say them out loud.
Love it. People have gotten the most value at the end part of this conversation. I have no doubt about that. definitely go find John Henry on Twitter. He's an amazing follow. Yeah, thanks for coming on, John.
All right, Ross, thank you so much for having me.
Hope you enjoyed this conversation. If you like this, we'd really appreciate it if you go to your audio and podcasting listener of choice, gave us a 5-star review, let us know what you thought. Your feedback is much appreciated and lets us get more great guests. Thanks for listening and get your listen on.